You're listening to Radio Mayapur with the best devotional, meditation, kirtan music, and inspirational podcast. This is Radio Mayapur.
Okay, here we are in Christ Church. We are in Christ Church today, and it's a beautiful sunny day, windy. It's a little cold because we are in the end of the world and this place is becoming winter. In the other part of the hemisphere, it's becoming summer. So in India, it's very hot, 35, 40 degrees. Europe, in Italy, I spoke with my friend Sergio yesterday. He told me the spring is coming, blooming, beautiful color, nice sky. And but we are in New Zealand, a very beautiful place. And today we are very, very fortunate to be with the temple president of Christ Church Temple of ISKCON. His name is Ramanuja Prabhu. I've been knowing him for many, many years, although I did not ever much associate closely to him, but I've seen him many times in Mayapur. He was born in Adelaide, in Australia. Very, very strange. He was born in my same birth date, 1/1/1957. I'm also born according to my passport to that same time. And he studied in Australia, and he joined in 1979. He met devotees. So welcome to our show, Ramanuja Prabhu. For Radio Mayapur, we are doing this interview to inspire all the devotees who are listening to us around the world, whether they're driving car or cleaning their kitchen or washing the dishes or cooking for the Lord. This is an inspirational podcast by which we are entering deep into the life of the devotees, because people meet you, they don't know your story, they don't know how in the world you come in contact with the devotees, how you, your life at a certain point change. So welcome, Ramanuja Prabhu. It's a great pleasure to have you with us, and thank you for hosting us. Me and His Holiness Banu Maharaj, we are traveling all around the world. You're giving us nice facility and nice prasadam and nice opportunity to be in contact with devotees. Welcome once again.
Thank you, Ikanga.
And I'll ask just a few questions. One is that, how was your life before you met the devotees? Tell us a bit about your family, your childhood. Your father was in the army, you told me before.
Yeah, we grew up. My father was in the military.
Nice.
So we constantly moved when we were children. I've got a brother who later joined the movement as well. I have a sister who later joined the movement also. Two other sisters who didn't take an interest in Krishna consciousness. So when we were young, we moved around a lot. And
sorry to interrupt you, but what was your father in the army? So we can understand why you were moving.
My father was... He was in the military, but he was a musician.
Okay.
In Australia, each capital city has a brass band.
Yeah, of course.
And so there was, back in the 60s, there was five big military bands in Australia. So he was eventually went on to become in charge of one of those bands. And on the weekend, he would play in a jazz band.
Wow. What instrument did he play?
In the military, he played a trombone,
a
euphonium, and a trumpet.
Wow.
And he was well worse. He was a very accomplished musician. He'd write the scores for the band and everything.
Beautiful.
And on the weekend, for fun, he'd play in a jazz band. And he used to play one of the big upright...
the upright bass.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
So from a young age, myself and my brother, we had a keen interest in music. And we used to play in a church band, the trumpet and stuff, myself and my brother. And then later on, a little later on, when I was probably a young teenager, I picked up the electric bass.
That's nice.
And during school, and then when I left school, that's what I did for a living. I was in a band.
Blues band?
Yeah, rock and roll.
Rock and roll.
Yeah, rhythm and blues.
Rhythm and blues, beautiful.
So that's what I was doing prior to joining. My mother, who was quite religious, my father had passed on by then, a motorcycle accident. He was killed. And my mother was quite religious, and she wasn't impressed with the fact that I was in a rock and roll band, because we know back in those days, it was a fairly unsavory lifestyle, quite the opposite of what we do now.
Absolutely.
But I enjoyed it for some time, and we were making good money, very good money, which
is strange. At that time, if you're playing the band, you don't make so much money.
Yeah, well,
you were going
we
up.
We were in a mid-tier.
What was the name of the band? Let us know.
Over the years, there was different names. Jagged Edge, which came from the name of a Jimi Hendrix song.
Right.
Later on, the band morphed into something different, and that was called Eargasm.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So, but during this period, I had started to become a bit disillusioned with the lifestyle, really. Not the music.
Of course.
It's like I had music in my blood. Yeah. But I started, at the beginning of the night, you'd start playing, people would come in, and then by the end of the night, everybody was trashed.
Yeah. Whether it was drug or alcohol this and that.
Everything.
Yeah, everything.
And it's like, and of course, we were playing, so we had to maintain some type of sobriety. Of course, we were doing what we were doing, but we had to keep it fairly straight to get through the night. But just watching, and I had a couple of friends, they didn't live with us, but I had a friend, a close friend I'd known for many years. She used to regularly visit the temple. And then she used to work in the restaurant doing the dishes. She was a junkie. She was a prostitute. But she had some affection for the temple.
Nice.
And at the end of the night, when the restaurant was finished, she would bring, because she passed our house on her way home to her house, she would bring us prasadam regularly. And it was... At the time, the devotee in charge of that restaurant was Bhutanath, well-known Australian chef, very well-known, and he was a wonderful cook. And so
started
to take prasad, and then, of course, at that time, the devotees were constantly in the street doing Harinam and selling books.
So you saw them, the devotees?
I saw them. I would avoid them, of course.
Of course, strange people.
A couple of times, the book sales, and this was near the end of Prabhupada's Leela, the book selling in Australia became very, very difficult. We had many devotees per head of population. I think at the time it was said per head of population, we had more devotees in Australia than any other country. So it was a small population, a lot of devotees, and it was difficult to avoid them.
You meet them everywhere.
Yeah.
In the airport, in a restaurant, in supermarket.
I got a couple of books, and the selling was, it was intense. They stick the book under your arm.
Come on,
and
take this one. Give me a couple of bucks.
One small book I read, and I was, meanwhile, my friend Cheryl, they were hosting, not regularly, but probably fortnightly or every 3 weeks, she would have a program at her house on a Saturday night for blooped devotees. And you know, back in those days, a blooper was almost an untouchable.
Nobody wanted to stay near them.
And so some of these, I started to attend that when I could, which wasn't that often because we were working Saturday nights.
Yeah.
But they were nice devotees, real nice devotees. They were all Prabhupada disciples because It was back then. And they just weren't able to maintain the standards. Living in the temple, yeah, as we know. It was intense back then. So
we should say you had to be fully committed and give your life to distribute books or whatever,
yes.
Preaching, and it was intense, yeah. And Arinam, and there was not personal life.
There was no downtime.
We live in a temple. I live in the temple as Brahmachari after Prabhupada left for 10 years. So, and but it was very blissful, I should say.
It was. So they were kind to me.
Yeah.
And then this friend, Cheryl, she prompted me, why don't you visit the temple? The first time I went to the temple, it was strange.
Which place?
That was Adelaide. Adelaide. I was back in Adelaide.
Oh, okay, you were
then.
Back in Adelaide, yeah.
But the feasts were phenomenal. And we had a reputation in Adelaide. Of course, every temple used to think they had the best feasts, but we did have a reputation for extremely good feasts. There was always two, three subjis, two or three savories, two or three sweets. It was phenomenal. So the prasadam I was attracted to, but when they would speak to me, that's a bit weird. And then one time she invited myself and a friend of mine. They were having a fire sacrifice, and it was a Sunday evening. And we were on the way back from the beach, and we thought, well, let's stop in, get a feed, and they're having a sacrifice. And I had these images in my head of
sacrifice.
What
is it?
And the Adelaide Temple, when you went up the first flight of stairs on the first landing, there was this huge wall-sized painting, the Nrisimhadeva painting with Hiranyakashipu on his lap.
Ripping off his intestine.
So I got halfway up and I clearly remember thinking, this is going to be great.
Sacrifice.
A fire sacrifice. And we sat in. I was a little disappointed because I was what it was going to be. And gradually, I used to go to the temple more. It's probably over the course of two to two and a half years. And some of the Bhutanath, the cook, was very kind to me. He was a nice man. And another devotee there, Prabhupada disciple, Pundarik, he was English.
Pundarik,
still lives in Australia. Yeah. He joined and was initiated by Prabhupada in Vrindavan.
Nice.
But he had left and rejoined and ended up in Adelaide. Nice. And he used to come to my house and
preach to you.
Preach to me and say, you know, this lifestyle you're living. And then at one point in time, Bhavananda was coming through and the devotee said, why don't you come and meet him?
Yeah.
So what transpired then was I was taken in to meet Bhavananda and he said, what do you do? And I said, well,
playing
a band. He said, are you married? And I said, no. And he goes, you know, you'll never be famous. I know some very wealthy, famous musicians. And if you haven't done it by now, you won't be. So just give up and join the temple. And I'm like, whoa.
What a preaching, man.
Dude, I just came to say hello. And what he did is just stay the weekend. See if you like it.
Yeah.
And if you don't, Monday morning, we'll drop you off at home. I'm off to the airport Monday morning. We'll drop you at home. So you got a couple of the Brahmacharis. One of them was Panjaratna, who still lives in Jaipur.
Yeah, Panjaratna from Jaipur, I know him.
A couple of Brahmacharis. Take him home, grab his things, and bring him back. And that was it. It was almost like a kidnap.
But you enjoy being in the temple, right?
Yeah, because like I said earlier, I was becoming disillusioned with the the lifestyle.
Material world is punishing everybody.
And I always had a healthy disregard for authority.
Yeah, of course.
Because
you were a rebel.
Yeah, and I wasn't trying to be a rebel.
But
school, when I put my hand up and ask questions, I was usually told to shut up.
Of course.
And I was like, why?
Right.
Why can't you just answer my questions?
Absolutely.
So, through reading, of course, and then being in the temple, everything, you know, questions were answered.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so I was satisfied with that, and I stayed. There was a couple of times where I disappeared.
In the first
couple of years, because, myself and Panjaratna, we were often in the desert.
Okay.
We were selling paintings by then. We were
in Australia.
Yeah. and we'd be right in the middle.
Nowhere.
Big cattle and sheep stations, thousands of kilometers from anywhere. So I was still a very young devotee, and we were out there by ourselves, and we just meet up at night. And one day I thought, I didn't join the temple to be doing this. And so I disappeared with the car. I came back to the temple a couple of weeks later. And then another time I had a friend that we grew up in the same street. His name's Lowy Tuksha now. He joined before me, and he traveled through India before he joined. And he was living up at New Govardhan, Brisbane.
Mm-hmm. He said, Gold Coast.
Yeah, why don't you come up here? It's much easier up here.
Beautiful place.
So, again, I left the temple without permission. And back in those days, when you left without permission, you were persona non grata.
Absolutely.
You didn't do that.
They didn't like you so much.
So that delayed me getting initiated for a good couple of years, because I was put in the unstable basket.
Yeah.
Even though I wasn't. But once I found my feet, I've never looked back. Yeah.
But I would like to say that maybe because your father trained you to always think, don't take things for granted, always question everything.
Question everything.
Because this is a nature of inquiring people.
Yes.
And people have vision, people have going through discipline, they always.
Yes.
I'm admiring your father. My father was the same. He said, hey, whatever you do, just figure it out. Probably use your brain and just do things, because people say.
And my father, he wasn't a devotee, of course. And he was like a common layman, but he was actually very intelligent. He had a very inquiring mind. And he was a thinker.
Nice.
And he used to tell myself and my brother, just put your hand up, question it. Because he used to say to us, they're full of garbage. And I was only 15 when he passed away, so I never got to spend in my real developing years quality time with him to pick his brains.
And
what do you mean?
It's amazing how this father figure, grandfather, they have so much wiseness.
Yes.
I still remember today my grandfather telling me things, about life, which at the time leave you shocked. Like, I'm 12 years old and he's telling me two things in life. I said, what? Don't run after money, don't run after woman. I said, whoa, what is this? And I was scratching my head. Why is he telling me this? He said, son, there are more women than men in the world.
Yeah.
And whatever money you're supposed to get, the Lord will give it to you.
Yeah.
So, I mean, simple answer, but very wise.
Yeah.
So these are things which you, in retrospect, you remember sometimes that pop in your head and say,
well,
I banged my head on the wall. My grandfather told me that, don't go that direction. And
I remember reading an article in an older Back to Godhead by a devotee in the US. I cannot remember his name, but he had left early in the piece and he'd been outside of ISKCON for two and a half decades, a long time.
Yeah.
And he'd come back. And because he was senior and he was a Prabhupada disciple, the younger devotees always came to him for advice.
Naturally.
And in this article, he was saying how he wished he had had more input when he was younger because he was viewed now as a wise old man. And he didn't consider himself to be a wise old man. And he was lamenting that he wasn't well-versed enough. Very interesting article.
Very interesting.
Because people see us like that now.
Yeah, we're getting old, even though I feel always like 20 years old when I join, but the body's getting old. But Ramananda Prabhu, then let our audience hear about your program you're doing here in Christchurch. You've been Temple President for a long time, and I know you're doing a lot of programs, outreach, yoga, studio, this, that. Tell us a little bit about the life of as a Temple President. How many years you're Temple President now here?
Here, it's about 15, 16 years.
Yeah, so
and it wasn't something I wanted to do.
No, of course.
Because, you know, I lived in India for many years.
Yeah.
And we were working on Srila Prabhupada Samadhi in Mayapur for 5 years.
I was
years.
There with you.
Yeah.
With the
so that's,
Kadamba Ganana Maharaj at that time he was.
After the upheavals of the mid-80s in Australia, there was, you know, it was worldwide. There was huge upheavals. At that time, Mahasringa Maharaj at the time, he'd been coming through Australia. So it got quite ugly at one point. A lot of people had left. And so he said, he was based in Mayapur.
Yeah.
He said, why don't you guys, you're on a sinking ship here.
Yeah.
Why don't you jump ship?
Save the ship.
So eventually we did, and in 1987, myself and Panjaratna, we gave notice, we did the right thing.
Yeah, of course.
We went to the festival in 86 and said, look, that's it. Here's a year's notice, we're going to live in India.
Yeah.
No, you're not. We are.
We are.
And the big stick's gone now.
Yeah.
So we did.
Nice.
And we were there for 5 years. And during that time, I used to travel every 6 weeks or so to Makrana in Rajasthan for buying the
marble
stone for the
stone.
Yeah, the red stone, the white marble,
stone,
everything.
Yeah.
So to get to Makrana, we'd go to Vrindavan and then go through Jaipur. And I used to say to Panjaratna, this Jaipur's a nice place. There's nothing happening.
Yeah, at the time there was nothing.
So when we finished with Mayapur, reasons for that won't go into.
Okay.
We thought let's go to Jaipur,
start a center,
and start a center. So we ended up there, and it was just myself and Panjaratna. We had one grass mat each, and a 1 liter pot. We didn't have a cooker, but we had a 1 liter pot. And we were staying in cheap hotels for the first 4 or 5 months. And, you know, you could get a room for 15, 20 rupees.
Yeah, it was cheap at the time.
And we were using rickshaws.
Not hotel, you stay in the Dharmasala. That was different from hotel. Correct?
Yeah, there's some Dharmasalas, some hotels.
Some hotels.
Because a big tourist place, a lot of cheap places.
Yeah.
And we met some life members who would then feed us. And we were given, at that time, Kadamba was then the temple president in Vrindavan. He gave us the life membership lists.
Nice.
So we were door knocking daily. But what had happened unbeknownst to us, was that for nearly 20 years, the Life Membership boys from Bombay,
they used Delhi, to come there
and where else? Vrindavan. Promised them the earth, give them next to nothing.
Yeah, and go.
And run with the money. So yeah. The first 18 months in Jaipur, some very nice people were like,
close
get
the
lost.
Door, don't want to see your face.
You guys are not trustworthy. But after the 18-month mark, we noticed a shift in people that, oh, they're not running away. They're still here.
Yeah.
And
it started a relationship.
Yeah. So for the first 3 years, there was just the two of us. It was good. You know, it was pioneering. It was preaching. It was India.
Yeah.
It was great. But then we got another devotee. And then another.
Start to expand.
Started to expand. And the fact that we just sat there all that time, then Krishna reciprocated. And you see it now. Beautiful.
Beautiful temple, lots of devotees.
Big congregation. And we have, I think, 12 or 13 centers in Rajasthan now.
Yeah.
And so during the course of that, Pantaratna married a local girl, and we had been together for a long time. In the Brahmachari Ashram in Australia, we traveled together on Sankirtan. We went to India together, Prabhupada Samadhi.
Nice.
We went to Jaipur together. So when he got married, I felt a bit... It's not that I had the urge to get married. I felt a bit isolated.
You know, just find yourself alone.
a long way from home.
Yeah,
and
alone.
The dynamic changes because he had a wife.
Of course.
And he spent less time with me. So I ended up getting married. And the person I married had difficulty in India. And of course,
Rajasthan's, she was Australian?
She's a Kiwi.
Kiwi, okay.
So.
Yeah, big jumps.
Harsh summers.
Yeah. Positive weather.
A construction site, dusty as anything. She was the only Western woman there. Nobody to speak
thousands
to.
Of people.
Yeah. And so it got tougher and tougher for her. So I had to make a decision, either move.
Or leave her.
And we tried the second option first. That didn't really work. And then on the advice of some senior devotees in Vrindavan, they said, well, deal with it now because you don't want that dragging you back in the future to deal with it in a future life. So I decided reluctantly to leave India and come here. And I've been stuck here since. So when I arrived, the plan was to spend maybe 6 months here and then, you know, work on our relationship, go back to India. That was my plan. Krishna and my wife had a different plan. So I'm still here.
Nice. So the preaching is going nicely here in Christchurch?
Yeah, it's we're not.
Well, you have a nice temple.
Yeah, so when I came here, we had a different building, and the management that was here at the time, there was some difficulty, and the whole management team left, and they took the devotees with them.
So you end up again being the only person.
So Ramai Swami, you know, he rang me and said, well, they've just walked out. The building's open. The deities were. So I went around to have a look, secured the building.
Right.
And then Ramai Swami eventually said, well, can you help out?
Yeah, can you take care? Naturally.
I was reluctant because I didn't come here to get into that. And then 6 months later, it's like I was the TP.
By default.
By default, yeah.
Yes.
And so we, the building, a beautiful old building, but it was run down. So then we set about renovating the building, which I think was a bit of a miracle itself because we had no money. The roof was leaking. Somehow we got a new roof. That was $40,000. And then we did the building up room by room. Beautiful building. And then in 2010, 3 years after I got here, there was the huge earthquakes.
Oh, yeah.
And it destroyed the building.
Completely fall down?
There was September 2010, that damaged the building, not beyond repair, but we were waiting for the insurance, the loss adjusters to come in and assess.
See how much we can.
And then in the meantime, in February, we had the real big one, destroyed the building totally.
No one was hurt.
No, Pajari was hurt, but not seriously, because the deities flew off the altar.
Wow.
I mean, it was a violent earthquake. And the Shingasan was pushed off the altar into the middle of the temple room.
Amazing.
And Janava Mata, who lives in Dunedin, missed her by a fraction, millimeters, missed her head, would have killed her.
Amazing.
So we own the property next door. I was in the property next door. I ran to the temple as it was imploding because it went for 25 seconds. So I managed to get to the temple. And it was destroyed. And the deities weren't, you know, it wasn't a broken arm or a broken leg. We were finding tiny, I got like a huge sack of tiny pieces.
Of marble.
Of marble. So initially the GBC was like, well, can't you just put the deities back together? There was other precedents.
Yeah.
And when I sent them photographs of, I've got thousands of chips here.
Yeah.
You work it out.
Same deity?
No.
Oh, different deity.
We did the Visarga, put them in the ocean.
Nice.
And then I thought, well, no point me being here anymore. There's no temple. So I was making plans to go back to India.
But the Lord, there's some other plan.
And then Ramai Swami asked, well, we're insured. Can you sort the insurance out? And I was like, that's going to be messy. It's going to be messy because the whole city was destroyed, not just our temple.
Not just you, thousands of people.
But my wife at the time, who was an accountant, she was working for the church property trust. The Anglican church here is quite strong.
Right.
In the city alone, they had four big cathedrals. So she was responsible for those properties of the Anglican church in this city. And there was many of them, but four big cathedrals in the city. So through her job, she was working directly at the coalface with the insurers who were based in Australia. Now, she was under contract that she couldn't speak because this was...
Naturally. Otherwise, a lot of people will come and claim them.
And after about probably 1 year of this, a year after the earthquake, she said to her boss, you know, my husband is in charge of the Hare Krishna temple. I'm doing this and I'm not allowed to. We can't live like this.
Yeah.
So her boss gave her, the CEO of the insurance, his card, who lived in Melbourne, and said, give him a call. So I rang him. And his name was Andrew Moon. And he said, do I detect an accent? I said, yes, I'm from Australia. And the first thing he said to me was, who's your football team? And for 20, 25 minutes, we talked football.
Football.
Aussie rules.
Yeah, naturally.
And it broke the ice. And I had some people I grew up with who went on to be then professional footballers, who he knew because he lived in Melbourne, and that's the headquarters.
Nice.
And probably after half an hour of this, he said, "Well, what can I do for you?" And I said, "Look, the Anglican Church has many properties. Even if they take a hit, they will be well reimbursed. We've got one." And this company was pulling out of the market because the losses were so big.
Of course, they cannot pay everybody.
So I said, "If you pull out, we've only got one church, so to speak. That's the end of us. We're finished." He said, "Call me back in 3 days. And I did. And he said, "I've got some good news for you. Tomorrow morning, there'll be a check on your desk." And the next morning, it was in our bank. It was $1 million exactly. Not a lot of money, but it was $1 million.
Well, it was not.
Yeah.
I mean, it was not nothing.
The following day, they pulled out of the New Zealand market. They were still meeting their obligations, but they were gone. So we got in by a day.
Nice.
So once we had the money, I thought, well, they've got their money.
I'm going.
They can build a new temple. Hasta la vista. I'm off to India. And I went to India.
Okay.
I told the devotees, you know, I've
done my job, done my duty, give you the box.
And so I was in Jaipur for about 4 months. And later on, during that time, I was in Vrindavan and I met Burijan. We've known each other a long time. And he invited me over for lunch. And he said, "What are your plans?" And I said, "Well, I think I'm back here now." And I said to him, "What do you think I should do?" And he said, "I can't tell you what you should do, but I think I know what Srila Prabhupada would say to you." And I said, "Okay."
Okay.
So it went like this. He said, "I'm pretty sure Prabhupada would say to you, go back, build the temple,
then
when you've done that, you can go where he wants." And it made sense.
Of course.
Because, you know, I was involved in the Samadhi construction in Mayapur.
You knew it.
We were building the Jaipur temple at the time. So I'd had a lot of experience. So I came back and it took us nearly a couple of years to find the right architect and engineer. And then March 2017, we finished this current
temple.
This temple.
Which is very nice.
Yeah, so. And since then, I've been sort of planning to.
India's calling you.
But there's obligations, you know, because you got to make sure things
are stable before. Yeah. I think because you're from this area, you know, it's good for you understand the mentality of the people, and you understand the mood, and you understand the government working. If anybody else come from any other part of the world, it will take them 10 years to figure out things.
Could take
you know?
A bit, but
of course, you're keeping Krishna in your heart wherever you are. Yeah. That's Mayapur, Prabhuji.
Yeah. You know, our experiences in Bengal and then Rajasthan, you know, just strangers in a strange land.
You are the white elephant.
But Krishna,
facilitates,
he guides.
Always.
Yeah.
Beautiful. So what are your future, apart from running away from this place and go to India? Any other future plan for the temple? Any new preaching or any new insight or restaurant? I don't know what. I know you're doing prasadam in different places.
Yeah, well, we do have a cafe in the temple
you
now.
Do. Yeah, nice.
Yeah. It's only a couple of days a week at the moment because of manpower. And, of course, the difficulty in this age is it's a temple. It's all grihastas. They all work.
Yes, so less time
limited.
To dedicate.
Yeah. And you know how that works. It's often difficult to expand with preaching.
Of course.
It's not impossible, of course, but
let's
really
say the times have
you.
Changed. There's not been many people all over the world that are traveling with Maharaj. There's not a lot of temple apart from India where people come and say, okay, I want to join the temple. You know, because people, let's say, most of the people we are preaching, they are already grihasthas, they're already working. And the young people, they are either too rara or study or getting a job. So there are very few people. Yeah. I say, in India, we still make a lot of brahmacharis.
Yes.
In Mayapur, we have 350 brahmacharis. Yeah. So all over India, we're still making brahmacharis because of the Sikh population.
Yeah.
And also because it's a culture.
Yes.
Like becoming a sadhu is a culture.
Yeah.
Like in Thailand, you know, there are so many people becoming monks.
Yeah.
So similarly, in India, the culture is to be part of a religious organization, learn discipline, you know, and everything. So but apart from that, I see the whole world is changing. The strategy of preaching to Grihastha means family member, people who are already settled in society. Yeah. You don't want to say, okay, leave your family and come and join the temple. I mean, nobody will do that and think you're crazy.
Yes.
So obviously, our is becoming congregation.
It's this congregation.
Am I correct in my assessment?
Yes. Yeah, I've noticed that over many years.
Yeah.
And then the difficulty, at least I find, and I don't think I'm unique, is that really distorts the authority structure. When it's congregational like that, people get initiated.
Sure.
They see their guru as the authority.
Sure.
And oftentimes the local authority is.
Well, you know, we have to make, my understanding is that we have to empower people to preach, number one, but we have to make people responsible and see how you are part of this community, you know. Maybe you're initiated by any guru, we get that under the guru will be in the future. But Prabhupada is the founder of Acharya. We are following his instruction. And you are living here. So, your guru will not tell you go to, Japan and preach there. You are here. Yeah, your guru is your guru, is representing your Prabhupada.
Yes.
But we are working here in a relation. So we can achieve something.
Yes.
So. And if we empower the devotee and we recognize them, that they are the people. Because many times His Holiness Bhanu Maharaj say, okay, before you are initiated, somebody's training you for 1 year to chant 60 rounds.
Yes.
Those devotees, most probably the temple president, and they are the guru. Because you are the one who give knowledge, train them to be on a platform of steady devotional service. So we should recognize all these devotees.
Yeah.
And we should not minimize them. Okay, now I'm your new authority. Don't listen to anybody else. So it doesn't work in that way.
Yeah.
And therefore, I mean, we are going to a phase where
people
are becoming aware.
Yeah.
So things, movement means we are moving.
Yes.
We're constantly moving.
Yeah.
We are not stagnating ourselves. So we are moving towards achieving the desired result of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's dream.
That's right.
Which is to spread the only name all over the world. And we have to adopt and we have to be flexible.
But
we have to empower people.
That was his push.
Yeah. So
Amata.
I love you, Ramanuja Prabhu. I can talk to you for many, many hours. Now, there is any parting message you would like to give to the Radio Mayapur who are listening to your podcast today? Something important which can upgrade their spiritual life.
Well, for myself, I joined the movement because the people preaching to me were disciples of Prabhupada.
Yes.
The books I was given were Prabhupada's books.
Yes.
And so I think I was lucky in that from the beginning, my heart was given over to Prabhupada, and I've never lost sight of that through the ups and downs. And
absolutely.
And it's the thing that's kept me, it's the single thing that's kept me here. Yeah, I've a couple of close friends, of course, the Punjratna and Jayapur and Mahasringa while he was still here. But ultimately, Prabhupada, I've never lost sight of. Without that mercy of Srila Prabhupada, I wouldn't be here. and absolutely. I wouldn't have remained here.
Absolutely.
And so I think it's important that we develop that attachment first and foremost for Srila Prabhupada above all else.
That's nice.
That means read Prabhupada's book.
Yes.
Listen to Prabhupada's book. Now they are available on audio format through Bhaktivedanta Vedic Library.
Yes.
You can hear all Srila Prabhupada's books.
Yeah.
And so, Kirtaniya Sadhari, expose your consciousness to higher dimension by listening to music, bhajan, kirtan, lecture, and every moment of your life is worth engaging in this.
I'm guilty of not reading every day, but I read most days.
Nice.
But at least at night time, when I go to bed, I put Srila Prabhupada on, the speakers under my pillow.
Nice.
And I get 6 or 7 hours, even though I fall asleep.
But see,
Prabhupada is pushed into my mind 7 nights a week. And he's been doing that for decades.
Nice. Wonderful. Thank you so much. It's going to be a great pleasure to meet you and speak to you and getting a glimpse of your life. And I'm sure that everybody will be inspired.
And thank you. I remember the first time we met when we were off to Bangalore, I think it was, for meetings, ICC meetings. And you were the temple president in what was then called Madras.
Correct, in Chennai.
We stayed there for a day or two.
Okay.
And the little
yeah,
I think building. It was blue. Was it blue or green?
Yeah, gray or blue, I don't remember. Was in Kilpak, which year it was?
Yes.
Yeah. Was in Kilpak Garden Road, yeah. It was.
Yes. And then you dropped us at the station.
Nice.
And off we went. I vividly remember that.
So thank you once again. Srila Prabhupada ki
jai,
Ananta Koti Vaishnavrinda ki
jai,
Hari Bol.
Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Mayapur with the best devotional, meditation, kirtan music, and inspirational podcast. This is Radio Mayapur.